right now 24 degrees in Kalamazoo. And I should have set up an elaborate joke about seeing Andrew Kohler again. it has been fairly frequent chats with you in the last few weeks.
Yes, it has. I really am so grateful to you for giving me this platform and for tolerating me so much. But it's just so happened that a lot of concerts have piled together very close to one another.
You've just been conducting so much repertoire lately.
It's been a lot of repertoire, yeah. It's been a lot to have in my head, but this is the last of this particular set right now. So that feels very nice. And this is the concert that I'll be doing with the Philharmonia this Saturday night, March 2nd, in our Dalton Theater. I'll say our Dalton Theater, meaning Kalamazoo College's Dalton Theater. And it's a program that is pretty special. I mean, I can't say that I think any of them are not special, but this one really, really resonates for me. So I'm mixing two different Viennese composers at slightly different parts of their career. There is the evergreen, ever-beloved Brahms Symphony No. 1, which is something, it's kind of like a huge stake for the orchestra, right? I mean, just so filling, so rewarding to have. And we're pairing this with another work that is much less well-known, but I think I've just, as I've come to know it more and more, I'm totally bowled over by its brilliance, and that is Die Seejungfrau, or The Mermaid, by Alexander von Zemlinsky.
Alexander Zemlinsky, slightly younger than Brahms.
Yes, definitely younger than Brahms, born in 1871 to Brahms' 1833.
A fascinating generational shift about to happen with, what's his name in the serial, the atonal music.
Well, yeah, you've absolutely intuited the direction of this program. I've titled it A Tale of Two Cities, but spoiler, it's all Vienna. It's just Vienna being sort of torn in two. It's a really amazing time, I think, right? You know, as we approach the turn of the 20th century in Vienna. So Brahms, of course, stands in for what a large majority of the Viennese audience, the bourgeois audience, wanted to hear. That is to say, the music of the great classics. And when they would deign to hear something contemporary, like Johannes Brahms, who did win favor with a large portion of the public, what they wanted to hear was someone who was really communing with the past. I would never suggest that Brahms sounds like Beethoven. He doesn't. He is his own composer, but he definitely wants to keep his works within the framework that would have been within a framework that would have been intelligible, perhaps to the earlier part of the 19th century. On the other hand, there's a group of younger composers who don't want to be bound by those strictures anymore, and they want to move forward. They want more progressive music. They want to sort of follow Wagner's example. They want to have their cake and eat it, too. They want to have Wagner's sort of over-the-top language, harmonic language, but pressed into the service of purely instrumental music. And Zemlinsky kind of ends up falling into that category. As a very young man, very early on, he does still write works that are quite conservatively conceived, and in fact win some favor from none other than Brahms. He gets an early boost in his career from Brahms, so the two knew each other to a degree. But then he starts pushing in this more progressive direction, and he actually has, I guess it's sort of an informal student-teacher, where he's the teacher relationship with none other than Arnold Schoenberg, whom, as you just alluded to, is the one who eventually liberated dissonance, as he put it, and invented atonal music. So it's very notable to me that Zemlinsky never quite gets there. He's a composer who pushes in this progressive idiom and keeps going, but never really makes the jump so that the tonal center is totally removed from his music, the way that his one-time student and then later brother-in-law, Arnold Schoenberg, would do.
So why isn't Alexander von Zemlinsky famous?
I think, you know, he was certainly in his day very well regarded. He taught not only Schoenberg, but also Korngold. And he also taught and fell in love with, by the way, Alma Schindler. And Alma, at the last minute decided to break things off and to marry a much older man, namely Gustav Mahler. So, I mean, he was right in the center of all these famous names we know in Vienna. And it's funny you should ask that. The way that I got acquainted with Zemlinsky's music was to discover his string quartets while I was still in college. And I wrote a senior thesis about those string quartets. And one of the things that I posited was that I think surely one of the reasons why his is not a name that is better known is because he was caught in that intergenerational gap, right? So he wasn't conservative enough to win the favor of bourgeois audiences the way Brahms might have, nor was he progressive enough to be remembered as a firebrand like Alexander von Zemlinsky. And then with this sort of
Schoenberg, you mean?
Schoenberg. And then with the ensuing sort of cultural loss, I think cultural memory loss of World War II, his was the name that just sort of disappeared. He ended up, of course, like most of those artists, having to flee Vienna once the Second World War set in, and died really rather unhappily in Larchmont, New York, of all unlikely places.
He was in the United States.
He was in the United States by the end of his life, yeah.
But what a special feeling as a grad student, you know, close to 100 years later, to find and fall in love with a composer's music and, you know, write about it, champion it, and here you are about to conduct one of his great tone poems, The Mermaid.
Yeah, and it is really a magnificent piece. And it's an effort that he and Schoenberg actually collectively made. They wanted to find a way that they could mix Brahmsian structural rigor with the sort of more progressive language of Richard Strauss, for example. So they wanted to be able.
It's not one or the other.
It had been for so long, and they exactly wanted to see if they could make those two roads meet up together. And I think in many ways he's wildly successful. The piece is the more I've come to know it, the more I've come to admire the craftsmanship involved in it. The density of thematic and motivic associations are really thick. I mean, there are just a few ideas, and he is able to spin so much from those few ideas. So it really is, in that way, very tautly conceived. And yet at the same time, it's this great, gorgeous, I feel sometimes like I'm taking a steam bath when I'm in the middle of conducting it, you know, because it's just, the orchestra is huge and the sonorities are gorgeous, and it's
a sensual pleasure.
It truly is. It really washes over you, and I hope the audience will feel that same sort of pleasure in just being in the center of this incredible sound that an orchestra of that size and so well handled, as Zemlinsky knows how to do, can make.
We've been remiss in not mentioning more often that the concert is Saturday. And will the concert begin at 8 p.m.?
Yes, exactly. 8 o'clock on this Saturday.
And that's located on the Kalamazoo College campus in the Dalton Theater of the Light Fine Arts Building, where the K-Phil has its home. There is a K-Phil website, Kalamazoo Philharmonia, the full name. And I want to talk about mermaids. Like, some mermaids are, well, mostly, I guess, they're temptresses that tend to lead ships and sailors onto rocks and ruin.
Right.
You know, things don't turn out very well. There are some sympathetic mermaids out there. Walt Disney, the little mermaid is.
Well, funny you should say that. This is that mermaid. Of course, not Disney's, but the original Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale about the Little Mermaid. That is exactly what this tone poem is based on. That's the inspiration point. And that is indeed a quite sympathetic mermaid. And one can, this was actually written very much in the wake of that betrayal from Alma Schindler, who became Alma Mahler, whom he had fallen deeply in love with. And then when she broke things off and said, sorry, never mind, I'm marrying this other guy, Gustav, instead. He was really crestfallen. He did eventually remarry, but he was really hurt by this. And so if you think about the broad arc of the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale, I mean, this is about a mermaid who gives up everything to be able to be human and falls in love with his prince, who then ultimately marries another. That surely was a story that resonated with Zemlinsky at that time. And I think it no coincidence that he was drawn to this particular text to start work on this tone poem. So the other details about the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale, because I assume that's probably less well known than Disney's. So there are very few calypso numbers in Zemlinsky's. just to let the
just
listeners
warning.
Know right now, yeah. instead, as I mentioned, there is a scene with what's called a mer witch, where the mermaid must give up her voice in order to have legs so that she can try and be human. So she is indeed mute, it has been a very long time since I've seen the Disney version, but I believe that happens in the Disney version. But instead of the happy ending, she realizes that mermaids don't have souls, or that's one of the contexts of the stories, and that only if she becomes human can she have a soul, an eternal soul. But she needs to have the prince fall in love with her in order for that full humanness to take shape. When this doesn't happen, when he instead marries somebody else, she is given one other option to return at least to her mermaid form, where she could live for hundreds of years. But in order to do this, she must kill him. And she cannot bring herself to do it. She tries twice and just cannot sort of stomach the thought of killing this man that she loved, even though he has betrayed her. And so she throws herself off the ship, imagining that she will just turn into sea foam, which is what she's told will be her fate. And she sort of does, but at the last minute, there's an intervention, and she is told that she will now be something like a luminous spirit, one that can do good works, and after a sort of quasi-purgatory, if you will, of several hundred years, maybe then still have the chance at earning a soul. It's a very interesting kind of compromise ending from Andersen, which he was criticized for, but which he felt very strongly was the right ending for his story, and he defended. And anyway, that moment of transformation is among the things that is really quite directly captured in Zemlinsky's music. Of course, Zemlinsky, like any composer setting out with a programmatic inspiration, isn't looking necessarily for like a play-by-play kind of recounting of the story, but rather maybe certain moments will be represented and then others will just sort of capture the psychological feel of the character. And that's exactly how Zemlinsky works. But the very final passages are indeed in this sort of radiant, beautiful major key that feel very much like repose, and you know, lots of lines that are sort of inching ever upwards. But there is in the middle of it a quotation of an earlier theme that we have come to recognize as that of the mermaid's yearning. So it's really a beautiful moment where sort of the beauty of those final moments is interrupted by a recollection that her needs, her deepest desire has not yet been answered.
I have such a desire now to have the whole piece narrated for me in concert.
No, I think that would be a terrible idea.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll use our own imaginations and listen for themes as best we can from the opening of The Mermaid.
Yes. Yeah, the opening sort of depicts the seabed, this great unfurling scales and the low basses and little splashes of color from the harps and the woodwinds.
Thank you. music of Alexander von Zemlinsky. If you tuned in during that lush music, you should know that it is one movement of three from a piece called The Mermaid. And this piece you have a chance to hear on Saturday. The Kalamazoo Philharmonia will be performing it along with Brahms First. And conductor Andrew Kohler is visiting with me here this morning on WMUK. That movement itself felt very complete from the beginning to the end.
It does, and yet it depicts really a very small part of the story. And the way that we can sort of know that is because it does seem a very, again, one of the clearer narrative mirrors in that music seems to come closer to the end. All that sort of energy appears to be describing a storm. Where relatively early on in Andersen's narrative, the mermaid saves her beloved prince from almost certain doom, and then pulls him ashore. And as she's pulling him ashore, apparently there are church bells distantly tolling. So we hear some church bells there at the end. I think that's what that's meant to fairly literally represent. And you know, I wanted to add. So Zemlinsky originally conceived of this as being a single movement work with multiple parts in it. And as you can hear, that first movement has a really, as I mentioned earlier, dense connection of motivic ideas. I mean, you hear the same themes kind of come circling back in a very Wagnerian way. But it's at the same time it's clearly not cast in sonata form or anything like that. It has episodic moments to it. Anyway, the music ultimately expanded to three movements, but I've opted to actually do a slightly abridged version to try and see if we can get back at a reimagining of Zemlinsky's original conception. So we will perform this entire first movement as heard, but then we will segue directly into the next movement. And then there is a moment in the next movement where he sort of previews what will be the end of the entire piece, and we're going to connect those two moments in the second and third so that we play it as one movement and also try and, like I say, reimagine what his original vision for the work was. He wrote about this in a letter to Schoenberg, actually. He himself obviously had some misgivings about the piece because initially there was a completed sketch for an extra scene in the second movement that he himself excised before the premiere. And then after the premiere, the premiere was sort of relatively well received, but it wasn't really rapturous praise. And for reasons that remain fairly mysterious, he just never tried to get the work published. Didn't really aim for subsequent performances. Had a few performances, and then he just sort of withdrew it from the public. And it was lost until 1980s. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No one knew about this music until the 1980s. And I wonder if that wasn't just the extreme sensitivity someone in his position would have to any kind of humiliation at that point. Alma Schindler actually heard the premiere and was. I don't know that Zemlinsky would have known this, but wrote in her diary some pretty devastating remarks. But I think, honestly, some of those came from this deep-seated now personal animus because she was trying to sort of excuse her own decision about the choice she had made. But she was quite uncharitable. But I can't imagine anyone hearing this music and thinking anything other than this is brilliant stuff and so atmospheric and so captivating.
So Viennese, old world in a way, but still the imagination flowing so vibrantly throughout. I did get, the sense of movie music and Richard Strauss as well.
Yes. All influences.
Things that became maybe tropes in Hollywood later on, but this was extremely new, original at the time. What time was this exactly?
1903 is when he completed this. And it's funny you should say this because another one of the students he worked with was Eric Korngold, who did go on to basically create the Hollywood sound as we know it. So in many ways, that there is a direct sort of lineage there.
Right. Alexander von Zemlinsky, a real bridge between generations. And it's a great chance to hear a piece only discovered in the 80s and, you know, not cropping up on lots of programs by major orchestras. So this is a great chance to hear it. And I know that the musicians in the orchestra are having a lot of fun with it. Every time I bump into one on the street or look at Facebook posts, they're quite excited and enthusiastic about it.
They're also happy to be in that steam bath.
Yes.
Yes.
We should continue on with some Brahms. Right now, 18 minutes before 11 o'clock. This concert is Saturday at 8 p.m. in the Dalton Theater at Kalamazoo College. Details at the Kalamazoo Philharmonia website. Johannes Brahms was a generation older than Zemlinsky. He started off as a kind of accompanist, pianist in a way. He toured with a great violinist of the time, and suddenly he's working on smaller pieces, chamber music, becomes friends with Robert Schumann and Clara Schumann, and his genius as a composer becomes more and more the focus.
Well, in a way, Schumann, I think, his early encounter with Schumann was something that really kind of set the course of his musical career, because Robert Schumann, who was a very influential music critic, probably much more well-regarded, well-known at that time as a music critic than as a composer himself, heard some of this early music by Johannes Brahms and was, I mean, just slathered on the praise. I mean, he said, you know, sometimes a genius comes fully formed like Athena from the head of Zeus, and this genius is Johannes Brahms, and he will carry the torch of the great classics of the past into the future in a way that the rest of us in this inartistic recent past cannot possibly fathom. I'm, of course, paraphrasing, but it was really the bit about Athena and Zeus was that is almost a direct quote. Schumann was really, really amazed by Brahms. I'm sure rightfully so. I mean, that's an incredible burden to put on a young composer, right? To say that somehow when no one else is able quite to figure out what the direction of music should be after the towering giant Beethoven dies, that this is the guy who's going to do it. And as it turns out, he ended up taking a very conservative approach to the answer of that question. Of course, Beethoven's Last Symphony, the Ninth Symphony, famously broke down the barriers between genre because he involved words in the symphony, which seems quite normal to us now, I suppose, because it's such a famous piece, and
that's
we know
not the definition of a symphony.
Exactly right. It totally cuts against the shared understanding of what a symphony was supposed to be. So he gave literal, concrete meaning to musical ideas, and so a lot of the 19th century struggled to figure out whether the lesson to take from that was that Beethoven was just extraordinary at composing, which he was, you know, just the sort of concentrated rhythmic and motivic energy of his music was enough to give it that romantic spirit, or whether it was the fact that he married word to that kind of writing that really revolutionized things. So Wagner obviously took an approach that said, you know, he actually used the phrase, he said in some of his writings, that the word redeemed music, you know, like give it almost a religious a connotation. And that, you know, his conclusion was that sort of uniting the arts in an operatic format was the only reasonable path forward, you know, that there was no point to writing symphonies anymore because that time had passed already. That was an artifact of that age, and the only way you could carry the spirit into the next age was to move to his music dramas. But obviously Brahms starkly disagreed and felt, as Schumann did later in his life, as did others along the way, Mendelssohn certainly, that there was still a place for the symphony as a vehicle for truly romantic expression. In other words, that the basic shape of the symphony, with its expected number of movements and the expected forms and the sort of rigor of its composition, that could still be malleable enough that it could hold romantic music within it. And so in the First Symphony, Brahms, I think, he was not prone to making great statements and manifestos like Wagner was. But at the same time, I think he very quietly makes his point, because the last movement has a theme which sounds, bears a passing resemblance to the Ode to Joy, which is, of course, the famous melody in the last movement of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. And actually, somebody pointed that out to Brahms, and he said, well, yes, any jackass can see that. So he was apparently a little annoyed about the it being pointed out to him. But, you know, it was obviously intentional. I mean, I think that comment suggests that it was intentional. And the point is, it does not have words. I mean, in other words, he's taking it back. He's saying what was great about the Ode to Joy was not necessarily the words, although that was fine that Beethoven did that, but rather the spirit of the music. And I can find a way to channel that spirit of the music and leave it within the purely symphonic realm.
Somehow I think it was the harder choice than to say, well, Beethoven broke the mold, so I'm just going to continue smashing molds, which is maybe the Wagner way.
Right.
But Brahms is like, the heritage that I received,
yes,
can be modernized for us today,
right,
with the same tools.
Absolutely. And that weighed on him a great deal. There's no question that it weighed on him. There's a famous picture of Brahms in his study, and there is a bust of Beethoven up on the wall, which suggests it's right near the piano, which suggests that he composed with Beethoven looking down on him. And he was quoted as saying, you have no idea what it feels like to hear the steps of a giant behind you all the time. And so how did that play out? Well, this First Symphony was finally premiered in 1876. It took 21 years from the first sketches until Brahms was finally confident enough to try and release this piece publicly. I mean, that must be one of the longest gestation periods of any composition that I can imagine. He just labored and labored and labored on it, and you can imagine why. I mean, here's this bust looking down on him. Here is the expectation of Robert Schumann, who, of course, by this point would have been dead, but, you know, sort of lingering in the air.
Nobody
saying,
had forgotten.
Yeah, of course, you know, saying that what an amazing genius this you know, that he will continue the brilliance of classics like Beethoven into the future.
And everybody's waiting.
Everyone is waiting.
First Symphony.
Yeah, so he keeps writing smaller orchestral works so he can kind of get a little practice seeing how things work. And then he writes the German Requiem, which is very well received, but also carefully avoids, you know, that symphony, right, which was the vehicle in which Beethoven so particularly excelled. But he finally did it. And, you know, you would think that, gosh, I mean, I would imagine that after 20 years of work on something that it could be self-defeating at a point. You know, you'd create this sort of self-conscious pastiche. But amazingly, somehow, Brahms lives up to his own hype and creates a work of really extraordinary genius. It was, by a famous conductor of the day, immediately announced as Beethoven's 10th, which I think Brahms sort of appreciated, but also was really annoyed by, as you can imagine perfectly, his psychological state at that moment. But, you know, the beautiful thing was that his second symphony followed in a number of months. I mean, once that extraordinary release finally was lifted from his shoulders, he then could compose with great freedom.
He chose the key of C minor. Is that significant?
Well, it's interesting because initially he was going to make it in D minor, which would have been the key of the Ninth Symphony. And then those sketches ended up being reused into his first piano concerto, which is nearly symphonic in scale. I mean, it's such a monster of a piece. C minor still has a very important Beethovenian connection, though, because that's the Fifth Symphony. So it's there, yeah.
Yeah. I have to let you go soon. We're near the top of the hour, and so let's just listen to some Brahms and say goodbye. Any particular movement from this symphony?
Well, I think the last movement is the one where we're going to hear that version of the Ode to Joy theme, that warm embrace that is now without words, but that nonetheless, I think we can all feel what Brahms wanted us to.
Andrew Kohler, tell us once again how people can hear your performance with the K-Phil of this piece.
Well, I hope you'll join us on Saturday night, March 2nd, Dalton Theater in the Light Fine Arts Center. Tickets available at the door. And as always, thanks so much for having me, Kara.
You really will never wear out your welcome, Andrew. I hope you hope to see lots of you again with the many adventures in music you seem to embark on.
Thank you so much.
Have a wonderful concert.